Hi, this is Bernie Wides talking, the naturalist. We're on the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting from beautiful downtown Bushwick. And our sponsor this morning is TechServe, a very good place to bring your equipment. And I'm going to do a show today about salt marshes. And I have a special guest this morning. Her name is Judith Weiss. And she wrote a terrific book in conjunction with Carol Butler. And Judith is in the studio with me, and we're going to talk about her book. It's a fascinating book. I read through the whole thing, and there's a great deal of information in it. So first, we'll talk to Judith for a while and find out how she got into this end of the environment. Judith, what was the tell me about you, your background.
Hi, I'm a marine biologist. I'm a professor at Rutgers University. I've been teaching a course in marine biology for many, many years and have been doing research in the coastal marine environment, including salt marshes and shallow water estuaries for many years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you've been working at Rutgers for how many years?
More years than I care to mention. But so this has really been my career in shallow water marine environments like salt marshes.
Right. So mostly salt marshes, not freshwater.
Not freshwater, no.
Stuff like that.
Salt marshes and estuaries. So always salt water.
Okay, great. And what about the evolution of the book? How did that come about?
It's a long history here. The original idea for this book was not mine. It was the idea of a naturalist in East Hampton named Mike Bettini.
Oh, yeah, I know Mike, right.
Approached me to, was I interested in being a co-author? And this was about 4 years ago. And I said yes. Suddenly the idea just appealed to me. I had not written any books up until this time. I had written a couple hundred scientific papers, journal articles, but never a book for the general public. But this idea just appealed to me immensely. Mike is not does not have a steady paycheck. Mike puts together his living by running field trips and canoe paddles, kayak trips, hikes, and stuff. So I started working on the book, and he didn't have time. And I worked some more, and he didn't have time because he needed to spend his time on something that would bring him an income rather than writing a book, which might
take years.
Take years and probably not pay a whole lot. So I kept writing, and he kept being busy trying to put together a living. And finally, about a year later, he said, you know, really, frankly, I'm not going to be able to do this, and you should go find another co-author. So I tried to contact several science writers that I knew, because it was clear to me at that time that I was not going to be able to write an easily readable book for the general public, having written only scientific papers in my career.
Right.
Writing is kind of dry and boring.
You have to change direction.
I need somebody to make it more. I'm gesturing, of course, that nobody can see me doing
okay.
This. To make it more easily read by the general public.
Yeah, you need somebody like S.J. Perlman, who wrote the scripts for the Marx Brothers. See, that would have livened it up a little bit.
No, or somebody, kidding. You know, like Stephen Jay Gould could write for the general public, Carl Sagan. You know, I'm not like them,
right.
Unfortunately. I wish I was. Huh. But anyway, so I approached one after another science writer that I knew or knew of, and they each thought about it, and eventually, for one reason or another, decided they couldn't. And I was kind of at wit's end, and at which point the editor at Rutgers University Press, who I had been discussing this whole issue with, called me and said, so what's happening with the co-author? And I told her my long, sad story. And she said, well, I think I have someone who might work out with to be a co-author. She has just co-authored a book about butterflies that we're publishing. And she's interested in doing more natural history books. Doreen said she's not a trained scientist. She's a psychologist, you know, practicing psychologist, but she's very interested in nature, and she's gotten involved with the butterflies. And, you know, and says Doreen Valentine, who is the editor. And she's a graduate of the Bronx High School of Science,
which is
the high school I went to. So I said, fine. And then, as it turns out, Carol Butler is not only a graduate of the Bronx High School of Science, but was in my class.
Really?
So
that's
we were
terrific.
High school classmates. We hadn't seen each other since graduation. And then got together to do this book together. And it worked out very well.
Terrific. And so that's how I came to know Judith, through Carol, because I work with Carol in the Butterfly Vivarium at the Museum of Natural History. And Carol Butler's been on some of the previous shows on bats and on butterflies. So when she told me about the Salt Marsh book and about Judith, I said, whoa, let's get Judith on, and it'll be great. We're keeping it in the family, Judith. So
right.
Carol and me and you and all the Salt Marshes. Okay, so let's get down to the topic now. Can you tell us in everyday language, not scientifically,
try to do it,
what a salt marsh is? Because most people don't know swamps from bogs, from upland marshes, right, from all that stuff.
Okay, these are all different types of wetlands, bogs and swamps and so forth. A salt marsh is a type of a wetland where the water is salty. So it's a type of a wetland near the ocean or near an estuary. An estuary is a water where the salt water has been diluted with fresh water, near a mouth of a river, for example, or where there are a lot of springs coming in, so that the amount of salt in the water is somewhat less than full-strength seawater.
Okay, so that's called the salinity, right?
The salinity, yes, is less. So that's what an estuary is. And salt marshes typically surround estuaries.
Okay, can you tell us, give us an example of salt marsh that people who live in this area could go and look at?
Hackensack Meadowlands, there's lots of salt marshes around Jamaica Bay.
Right.
Those are the biggest ones in the metropolitan area. There's some, I think, along the Bronx River.
Yes, some restorations of marshes are being done. So if people, you know, the people's impression of salt marshes are it's a place where there are a lot of mosquitoes and those nasty greenhead flies that bite you. And, you know, they look at them as useless. And a lot of people live in houses that were once salt marshes that was filled in. So can you tell us why a salt marsh is important in the scheme of the ecosystem here?
Okay. What you say about salt marshes being places for mosquitoes and being useless is the prevailing attitude up until perhaps 40, 50 years ago, when enough study was done to realize that salt marshes are playing a vital role in nearshore ecology. The salt marshes provide a lot of habitat for a lot of animals. And so there's a lot of marine animals that either use salt marshes through their whole life or use them during part of their life. There's many important commercial species of fish that will have their embryos and juvenile stages living by salt marshes.
Okay, so they have a direct effect on the seafood that we eat.
Exactly.
So that's one reason really important.
It's not just the seafood we eat, but for the general ecology of, you know, the nearshore marine environment, that they're playing an important role. They also are highly, highly productive areas. That means there's a lot of stuff growing there, a lot of plant material, a lot of animals. And when people think, you know, what's a really productive system, they tend to think of things like coral reefs or
rainforests. Right.
And salt marshes are up there with those. They're not quite so charismatic, perhaps, not so glamorous, but they're up there as being among the most highly productive systems in the world. Furthermore, salt marshes play important roles in retarding flooding in case of storms, hurricanes, tsunamis, you name it. They're a buffer for the land inland when there's big waves, big storms, a lot of wind. If you have a substantial marsh there, there will be much less damage produced inland than if there was no marsh there.
So it actually cut down on the velocity of the winds and the tidal surges
exactly.
and things like that?
And this became quite obvious after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans.
Okay, so on that note, we're going to stop a second. Well, we were talking about Katrina. We all remember that destruction. And we're going to take a break now for a minute, and we'll be right back with some more mysteries of the salt marshes. Hi, we're back on the air now from the Heritage Radio Network, sponsored by TechServe. And we left the story when we were talking about Hurricane Katrina in Louisiana. So let's talk a little bit more about that, because it was such a big event. How could they have, they couldn't prevent the storm, but how could they have cut down on the damages in Louisiana?
Louisiana used to have huge amounts of salt marshes, and the salt marshes in Louisiana are being lost at an incredibly fast rate for a variety of reasons. I don't know if I'm going to have time to go into all the reasons here, but the incredible loss of salt marshes makes the inland part of Louisiana so much more vulnerable than they would have been if they had had all their marshes intact. The similar thing was seen in 2004, the big tsunami in the Indian Ocean.
Right.
On the island of Sri Lanka was damaged extensively. Now, in the tropical areas like that, there aren't salt marshes. There are mangrove swamps
right.
that are in the same location on the shore, you know, growing half in the water, half on land as the tides go up and down. And in areas of Sri Lanka where they had cut down their mangroves, there was a whole lot more damage from the tsunami than in the areas of Sri Lanka where the mangroves were intact. And you have this whole network of roots and trees as a buffer, slowing down the big tidal wave and breaking it up so it does much less damage inland.
It absorbs a lot of the energy of the wave.
Right.
So they serve basically the same purpose as a salt marsh.
Right.
As a buffer,
yeah.
and also probably as a nursery
exactly,
for critters
they do.
That live there.
Exactly.
So we now know how important salt marshes are, and let's talk about who lives there in the salt marsh, because I know a little bit about the food chain or food webs. So what starts it all off? There must be a beginning of this food chain or food web.
The beginning of a food chain is always the organisms that make their own food that are photosynthetic, generally green, generally called plants.
Right.
And in the salt marsh, there are a variety of different species of plants that we find. One species, I'm talking about East Coast salt marshes here. There's one species of plant that tends to be the predominant one that grows right by the water and is underwater about half the time, which is the cord grass, or Spartina alterniflora is the scientific name for it. This is a grass that is so highly adapted to being underwater half the time and even more extreme is being under salty water.
Right, that's a tough environment to live in.
It's a very tough environment. If you put salty water and submerge most any other plant, it would die pretty soon. But this plant is so well adapted, it can it deals with roots being in underwater with no oxygen, mm-hmm. basically, and it's dealing with salt. The way it deals with the salt is to pick it up and excrete it through the leaves. So you could go down to the marsh on a sunny day and look at the back underside of the leaves and see little white dots, which are salt crystals
that
the plant has excreted. So this plant is highly adapted, and that's the one that's growing right at the water's edge. And you work your way back up the marsh. It tends to have a slight slope. And there are a variety of other species of plants that you find at different regions. So where the spartina, the cordgrass, is the low marsh, and then you have a mid-marsh area mm-hmm. with some other species, and then a high marsh. The plants up in the high marsh are hardly ever underwater,
right.
but they will get sprayed. They will have
a
salty
spray.
Environment
right.
by their roots, but never be underwater the way the plants in the low marsh are.
Okay.
So these are mainly...
Zonation. Zones.
That's called zonation. Different
okay.
plants... I wish they could see.
we're both making hand motions.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Different plants at different levels okay. on the marsh, depending on how well they can tolerate the environmental conditions
okay. now,
there.
What about in the water itself, the primary producers?
All right,
the little
water,
green plants.
In the water itself are what we call phytoplankton, that are single-celled plants, generally called diatoms or dinoflagellates. And so they are the main primary producers of the whole ocean. But here in a salt marsh, you've got, in addition to these little guys in the water, you've got all these big grasses. And there's also some seaweeds that we find in salt marshes. There's a seaweed called rockweed. That's a mm-hmm. brown algae
yeah,
that attaches
to the rocks and stuff,
on
right?
rocks
yeah.
and stuff. So you see that. There's also what you don't see that appear to be really important are single-celled plants that are closely related to the plankton in the water, but they're not living in the water. They're living on the surface of the mud of
right.
the marshes.
Okay.
And scientists call these microphytobenthos.
Oh,
and that
fancy.
Means micro is little, yeah. phyto meaning plant, and benthos meaning on the bottom.
On the bottom, right.
So
there are mats of these covering
these
the mud.
These are covering on the mud and
right.
very inconspicuous. And in the past 20 years, people have been studying them and realized how important they are. And they've been referred to as a secret garden because
okay.
they're not so conspicuous.
Are they related anyhow to cyanobacteria? Are they similar?
No, they're more similar to diatoms that are in the plankton.
But they're just smaller? Are they?
No, they're about the same size. They are, in fact, many are diatoms. They really
okay.
are diatoms. They're just different species than you find floating in the
okay.
water.
Okay, are they sessile? Are they attached to the substrate, or they're just sort of
They're sitting on the substrate.
Okay.
They can migrate just below the surface or be right on the surface, and they seem to migrate up and down a little bit.
Okay, so these are important because they're green plants.
Right, and they're photosynthesizing, and they're also important food for small animals that eat them.
Yeah, well, let's just refresh everybody's memory. You learned this in high school, probably, about photosynthesis, because most people remember it vaguely, and it has something to do with carbon, something to do with oxygen, and all that. So very briefly, photosynthesis is...
Very briefly, the plants are taking in carbon dioxide and water, and through a complicated series of reactions, they're making their own sugars
right.
and releasing releasing oxygen into the water.
Okay, so that's why they're so important, right? That they're making oxygen and that they're reproducing themselves.
They're making their own food.
They're making their own food.
They don't have to eat something to get
right.
food. They're manufacturing their own food. And then everything else is dependent on the food they manufacture.
So they're like the grasses in a meadow.
Well, right.
And then everybody eats the grasses. So in the sea, these little plants, the diatoms and these mud benthic micro
Flora.
Are at really at the bottom of the food chain.
They're the beginning.
So the little
of the food
critters
chain.
Who live in the ocean in the salt marshes, like the zooplankton, right? Well, they'll graze on these plants?
Right, as well as things like mussels and clams that are what we call filter feeders.
Yeah, how does that work, filter feeding? Do they have a little coffee filter they use to filter
they
out
have
the
little
stuff?
Structures that pump the water through, and they grab the particles out of the water, the small plant.
Okay, so...
Single-cell plants
what,
and little
what they,
animals.
That's what they eat.
Yeah, these filter feeders.
They filter feed. I always picture my Melita filter paper, but...
Well, it's catching
it's
material.
It's catching material,
right.
Yeah. Okay, so that's good. We started off the food chain, and maybe on our next segment, we'll move up the food chain. The stuff that's really things that we eat.
Right.
And that are important in the sea. So we're going to sign off for another minute and take a break. And then we'll get back to the third segment of this show. Okay, Judy, thanks, and we'll just take a little break now. Here we are back in the salt marsh. Luckily, it's low tide today, so we're not sitting in water. But someday Bushwick may be underwater, you know, with sea level rise and all that. So we'll have to have the broadcast from the roof up here where the garden is. But right now we're doing fine. We're back in Bushwick at the Heritage Radio Network. And my guest today is Judy Weiss, who is a professor at Rutgers University, and we're going to do this segment. We're moving up the food chain now. We spoke about the little tiny producers, which are single-cell green plants or multi-cell green plants, and they are, I think the fancy word is autotrophs. Is that right? They make their own food.
Yeah.
And everybody else are heterotrophs. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to talk about the critters that eat these plants and depend upon them, and the critters that we eat that depend on the critters that eat the plants. So, Judy, let's move up the food chain a little bit.
Okay. Depending on which you're starting with, at the bottom of the food chain, you get into different animals that consume it. Obviously, if you're starting with single-cell plants like phytoplankton or the little guys, the single-cell plants on the mud, they're going to be eaten by things that are pretty small.
Like
zooplankton.
Like copepods,
like
would that be an example?
Copepods or larvae of various things. Very
that's
small,
important, right.
Very small animals.
Right.
The most conspicuous primary producers on a salt marsh are, of course, all these grasses.
Mm.
And if you think about a grassland that's on land, you would have herds of things like antelope or deer or zebras or something grazing on the grasses.
Not in Brooklyn, no zebras in Brooklyn.
No, not in the Prospect Park Zoo.
No, they moved them to the Bronx Zoo. They didn't like the food in Brooklyn. It was not good. Okay, good.
Anyway, in a salt marsh, you don't have big herds of zebras and antelopes and stuff grazing on it. Most of the production of all those grasses that comprise the conspicuous part of the salt marsh isn't used by animals until these plants have died and decayed.
Okay.
So what happens in the fall here is that the plants turn yellow, brown, they die
mm-hmm.
in the fall, and they fall over onto the surface of the marsh. and they are worked on by fungi and bacteria in the process of decay. And as the plant material is colonized by the fungi and bacteria that decay it, the plant material gets smaller and smaller and turns into what we call detritus, which is just decaying plant material along with these microbes. Mm. And that's what a lot of animals eat.
Okay, the detritus.
Snails, clams, crabs, worms. Oh, there's a lot of animals in the shallow water area that we call detritus feeders.
Right.
That get a great deal of their nutrition from this detritus. But also, it turns out, they're eating those microphytobenthos, those single-celled things on the mud, are mixed in with the detritus.
So that's the protein in their diet.
The protein, well, a lot of the protein is coming from the bacteria and fungi
right.
that are doing the decaying.
Decomposing, right.
It turns out that it's much richer diet to eat detritus than it is to eat living plant material.
Don't tell Kellogg's about this, because I can see a cereal coming out. Detritus cereal with raisins and stuff like that. They'll advertise they're at the bottom of the food chain and you're on the top, so I could just see the commercial now. So, okay, we won't tell them about it.
All right.
Sorry, go ahead.
But anyway, the detritus is better food than the living grasses because
okay.
it's got more protein, the protein coming from the bacteria and fungi.
And it's partly digested already, I guess, then. Would you say that?
Well, yeah.
It's broken down into...
It's partly broken down, but it's also got this protein that,
right.
that a living plant doesn't have.
Okay. So that's the primary producers, we'll call those.
The plants are the primary producers, and what we're talking about now are the animals that eat them. So you could call them primary consumers.
Okay.
And then you get bigger animals that eat those animals that we would call secondary consumers.
Okay. And the secondary consumers are some of the things that we eat.
Right.
Okay, so...
Bigger things.
And so let's talk about seafood for a minute.
Okay.
And because I know the salt marshes a lot of times are nursery grounds for a lot of things that
right.
we eat. And some of the critters live there all the time, like blue crabs or other stuff.
Blue crabs live most of the time in estuaries, but may go up... way up the estuary into practically fresh water
during
some time. And then the blue crab, the females lay the eggs near the outlet of the estuary. So the young, the larval stages are pretty much in the nearshore ocean and then come back up in the estuary to settle out and turn into juvenile crabs.
Right.
Is a similar... It's an important crab that's I guess you would call it a primary consumer, unlike the blue crab that eats a lot of other animal food.
Yeah.
Fiddler crabs
are really
important in salt marshes. They dig burrows on the edges of creeks, and their burrows serve to aerate the sediment down lower, which is good for the plants that are growing there.
Just a word about fiddler crabs. Probably everybody has seen them if they've been at low tide, maybe at a marsh. But they are these funny-looking little crabs. You know, all crabs walk sideways. And the fiddler crab has one huge claw and one tiny little claw. The males. And that's why they're called fiddler crabs. It looks like they're carrying a fiddle around with them. And they really use it to bluff other males to say, stay away because I have the biggest fiddle around. I'm going to beat you over the head with my fiddle, or something like that. But they are really important as food for a lot of other critters, right?
Right. But I just say another thing about waving the big claw around. It's not only telling other males to stay away, it's also attracting
the females
and saying, come hither,
I'll play my fiddle for you.
Right.
Okay.
And so you can go to a salt marsh at low tide and watch these animals are active at low tide, which is highly unusual. You'd think they would
hibernate at
low tide and be active at high tide in the water, but they're not. They're active at low tide. So you can sit down with binoculars, and if you're still and don't move around, you can watch them, and the males will come out and they wave their fiddles around, or you can watch them feeding. They're great fun to watch. They're very cute, and they're also, you know, very small and harmless. You're never going to get hurt by fiddler crickets.
Yes, you think of it'd be possible to organize them into little quartets, like little...
Well, I haven't seen quartets, but I've seen what look like exercise classes where the males are raising up their claw and coming down, waving synchronously up and down.
Oh, really?
Looking like an exercise
class.
Like a
Tai Chi class or
something.
Right,
exactly.
That would be quite a sight, right?
So these are, you know, among the animals that are most easily observed because they're basically out of the water.
At low tide.
Watching fish is a little harder.
Sure.
Because they're in the water.
Yeah, I know you have to be very quiet when you watch fiddler crabs. Because even the pressure of your footstep on the ground could make them scurry back into
the... Oh, they scurry back in the burrows. Yeah, the burrows are really important as a refuge for them. It's a hiding place. It's where many of the species of fiddler crabs mate.
Right.
And it's...
help to aerate the
It aerates
too?
The mud, and it's beneficial for the plants, too.
Yeah. Okay, so we didn't get very far up the food chain, but we spoke about fiddler crabs who are eaten by other crabs, and the little critters
and
who are eaten by big critters and fish, and eventually it gets to us, because we are really at the top of the food chain, because we are predators, and we can catch and kill anything we really want to. So we are at the top of the food chain, even in the ocean. Sometimes they say the orca is the top of the food chain, but I think we are really. What do you think, Judith?
Well, sometimes you might say the mosquitoes are the top of the food chain.
Oh, that's right. They skip all those steps.
And the green eye flies.
And they bite us. Yeah. That's true. Okay, we're going to sign off now on this introduction to salt marshes. I want to thank Judith for being here and giving us enlightenment. And all her years of experience. And we've been brought to you by TechServe, and this is the Heritage Radio Network, and this is the Naturalist program. And we're going to sign off. And if you're really interested in salt marshes, you can do your own research, or you can buy the book. It's available on Amazon and all other bookstores. And it's a very nice book. It's a great introduction to salt marshes, and it's good for families and for people who really want to learn about this great ecosystem.
The title.
And the title is Salt Marshes, A Natural and Unnatural History. And for another show, we'll talk about the unnatural history of salt marshes. And the author is Judith Weiss and Carol Butler.